Welcome to Torah Mecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Lynn Kraft, and today we'll be learning Eicha, Perek Aleph, Chapter 1. But before we begin learning Perek Aleph, I'd like to start with a more general introduction to the Megillah as a whole. So this year will likely be a little bit longer than those following. Many of the following ideas were gleaned from different books, articles, shiurim, by Mrs. Molly Brofsky, Dr. Gabriel Cohn, Rabbi Chaim Angel, Rabbi Yitzhak H. Shalom, Dr. Yael Ziegler, and Mrs. Yael Leibowitz. So thank you to them for their nice ideas. As many of us know, Eicha is one of the Chamesh Megillot, which are each read publicly in shul at different points throughout the year. Megillat Eicha is read annually on the night of Tisha B'Av, the fast day when we mourn the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, since that is its main subject matter. The setting of Megillat Eicha is Yerushalayim after the Chorban, the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, or Temple, in 586 BCE. And after a year and a half long siege of the capital city, Yerushalayim, the Bavlim, the Babylonians, breached the walls of the city and destroyed everything therein, the buildings, the people, the temple itself. In fact, they succeeded in knocking out the three main elements of the Jewish religion. First, Malchut Beit David, the Davidic dynasty, which Bnei Yisrael had thought would last forever, in that Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian emperor, killed the last Davidic king, Tzidkiyahu. Second, Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, since the Bavlim exiled the people to Babel, to Babylon. And finally, the Beit HaMikdash in their destruction of it. And I think it's also important to realize that the Beit HaMikdash was much more than just a physical building of stone where Bnei Yisrael offered karbanot or sacrifices to Hashem. It was the center of Judaism. It was where the Jewish people gathered to perform all of their religious rituals. And the way that Bnei Yisrael at the time connected to Hashem and Judaism was through the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, with its loss, they lost the cornerstone of their religion. And the people therefore dealt with a crushing loss, both in the physical forms of their temple and their city, but also in their personal and religious identities. On top of their shock and their horror at their physical suffering and their loss of dignity, they were forced to ask many existential questions regarding how they could continue to survive with all of the central aspects of their religion having been stripped away. Even deeper than that, they had to ask many theological questions regarding how their own God could do this to them. Megillat Eicha is not a historical description of the destruction. That's found at the end of Sefer Melachim Bet and in Sefer Yirmiyahu as well. Rather, Eicha constitutes an emotional response to the tragedy. The Megillah describes the psychological, emotional, social, and theological trauma that Bnei Yisrael experienced in the wake of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and of Yerushalayim, which was the capital city of the land of Israel and the entire Judean kingdom. The purpose of the Megillah, therefore, isn't really to tell the facts, although it does include some, but really to have the reader relive the experience. In this way, Eicha can be viewed as an example of what's known as expressive literature in Tanakh, a genre that includes many Mizmorei Tehillim and the Megillah of Shir HaShirim. And it's so called because the writer expresses various emotions. As opposed to Shir HaShirim, though, which expresses joy and desire, Megillat Eicha expresses sorrow, mourning, and despair. Ironically, Shir HaShirim, which expresses such happiness, was written by Shlomo HaMelech, the king who built the Beit HaMikdash and therefore lived in the beginning of its era, whereas Megillat Eicha, which expresses such sorrow, was actually written at the end of that era in response to its destruction. Yet it's important to note that the purpose of poetry is not just to express the writer's emotions, but also to elicit emotions in the reader. And therefore, the purpose of Megillat Eicha is both to express the mekonen, the lamenter, the writer's emotions of grief and mourning, but also to elicit similar emotions in us as we read it or hear it. Eicha can actually be compared to Sefer Iov in that they both deal with tragedy, but they stand in stark contrast to each other in terms of how they each respond to that tragedy. Sefer Iov reacts from a philosophical perspective and is therefore a prime example of wisdom literature in Tanakh, whereas Eicha reacts from an emotional perspective, which is why it's considered an example of expressive literature, as we discussed. While Iov deals with the question of why did this happen, Eicha deals with the question of how could this have happened, reflecting a sense of shock and astonishment at what transpired. According to the Gemara in Bava Basra, Daf Tet Vav Amud Aleph, it's Yirmiyahu who wrote Megillat Eicha, and is therefore known as its Mekonein, as we translated the its lamenter. This was in addition to his having written Sefer Melachim to explain the historical perspective of why the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and his own Sefer, Sefer Yirmiyahu, to share the nevuot, the prophecies that he received from Hashem and delivered to the people in the events immediately preceding the Chorban, the destruction of the temple. In fact, there are actually many parallels that can be found between Yirmiyahu's own Sefer, Sefer Yirmiyahu, and Echa. They both describe the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and Yerushalayim, the connection between the people's sins and their suffering. They both discuss Hashem's being the prime cause of the events. They both denounce Nevi'i Sheker, false prophets. They both discuss the futility of the people's reliance upon foreign nations for help. And they also both discuss the ultimate defeat of Bnei Yisrael's enemies. Similarly, the events described in Echa Perek Gimel, which are presented from the perspective of the Mekonein, they actually echo events from Yirmiyahu's own life, such as being thrown into a pit, being physically abused, being almost killed, being mocked by his enemies, living in solitude, and other themes as well. And there are also many linguistic similarities between the two Sfarim in terms of both common phraseology and also common imagery, including images and phrases that are really primarily only found in these two Sfarim as opposed to the rest of Tanakh. Yet what's interesting is that despite its well-known Mekonein, the Megillah seems to intentionally obscure his identity, not mentioning Yirmiyahu's name even once in the text, perhaps because it might serve to distract from its contents, or perhaps because the Mekonein's fame and position in society might serve to distinguish him from the people who are suffering, and he would really instead prefer to join the nation in their grief. In this way, Echa becomes applicable to everyone in Bnei Yisrael, representing the catastrophe and subsequent response of mourning experienced by the nation as a whole. As opposed to many other narrative literature in, or many other instances of narrative literature in Tanakh, there are no characters in Megillat Echa. Interestingly, though, there are multiple narrators who offer, you know, various perspectives. We have the third-person account of the Mekonein. We have the first-person account of Yerushalayim herself, presumably speaking on behalf of her inhabitants. We have the first-person singular account of the Gever. We have the first-person plural account of the people. And the variation of voices provides different emotional responses to the Chorban, and it also calls attention to the absence of Hashem's voice in particular, which is likely not present because of the Megillah's focus on the human response to suffering at the hands of Hashem. Now, most poetry in Tanakh is characterized by a balance meter, which connotes joy, happiness, security. Echa's meter, though, is not balanced. The first half of each pasuk is longer, and then its second half is shorter, kind of fizzling off before we expect it to. It kind of slows down, it's weaker, as if the mourner is running out of breath. And this kina meter, as it's been described, is really meant to, or seems to be meant to reflect mourning and trauma and the pervasive feeling by someone who's suffering of imbalance in their lives. And this imbalance meter, as I said, is so unique in Tanakh that it's been known, it's been named as the kina meter. Most poetry in Tanakh is also characterized by the presence of what's known as parallelism, in which the two halves of the pasuk are parallel to each other. But in Echa, parallelism is generally lacking, perhaps further demonstrating a lack of equilibrium in the life of the mourner, that he lives in an imbalanced world where disorder prevails. Interestingly, and something that makes Echa pretty unique amongst other Sfarim in Tanakh, is that there is a distinct alphabet structure throughout the Sefer, with the first four prakim, or chapters, arranged as acrostics from Aleph up until the last letter Tav. And each parak therefore contains 22 psukim due to the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, with the exception of Perek Gimel, which has 66 psukim, because it has three shorter psukim that are devoted to each letter. The only exception to the alphabet rule is Perek He, the fifth chapter, which does not follow the alphabet acrostic, but is still comprised of 22 psukim, corresponding to the number of letters in the alphabet. And the question is why? Why did the Mekonein specifically decide to structure Echa in specifically as an alphabet acrostic? And there are several different suggestions that have been made for this structure. First, perhaps it's because it makes the text easier to memorize, which was especially important back in the day. Before books were abundant and available for widespread use, it made it easier for people to remember. A second suggestion is that perhaps it conveys the totality of the destruction and the subsequent anguish that the people felt without needing to lament all day. Kind of like Ashrei, for example, includes all the letters of the alphabet to convey the totality of its praise of Hashem. Or Vidoy includes all the letters of the alphabet to portray the comprehensive nature of our sinfulness. In fact, this idea is applied to Eicha by the Medrash Lekach Tov on Eicha Perek Aleph Pasuk Aleph, which says, V'lama ne'emru kino b'alphabet? Why was Eicha written in alphabetical order? Himavru me'alaf v'ataf, lefichach laku me'alaf v'ataf. Because the people sinned from Aleph to Tuf, in other words, in totality, completely comprehensively, they violated all the sins in the book. Therefore, they were punished from Aleph to Tuf. They were punished in a very total and complete fashion. One final suggestion as to why Megillat Eicha might have been written with this alphabet acrostic is that it helps maintain order in the midst of the Mekonein's grief. Because when someone is suffering so much, his emotions may become so overwhelming that he doesn't or she doesn't know what to do with them. And in this way, the alphabet acrostic maintains a structure within that feeling of being overwhelmed to create a certain sense of order. Unfortunately, the Horban to which Eicha responds was not unplanned, and it was not unexpected. Yirmiyahu, many other Nevi'im and prophets warned Bnei Yisrael about the impending dooms in many generations immediately preceding it. And even Hashem himself warned Bnei Yisrael hundreds of years earlier about the potential for exile and destruction as a punishment for sin. This warning of Hashem's even appears in the Tochacha, the rebuke section of Sefer Devarim, particularly in Parshat Ki Tavo, in Prakim Chav Zayin to Chav Chet, chapters 27 and 28. And in fact, there are many parallels that are seen between these psukim and Eicha, demonstrating the Mekonein's belief that the destruction that unfolded and the suffering that Bnei Yisrael experienced were really an exact fulfillment of Hashem's promises in the Torah. Now I'd like to focus on today's Perek, Perek Aleph, Chapter 1. Perek Aleph can be divided into two sections. Psukim Aleph to Yud Aleph, verses 1 through 11, are said in mostly third person, with I think one exception. Where the Mekonein describes the suffering of Yerushalayim from a third-person perspective, and then from Sukkim Yud Aleph to Chaf Bet, verses 12 to 22, which are mostly said in first-person, again with, I believe, one exception, in which Yerushalayim laments her own suffering. The overall theme of the Perek is the desolation, emptiness, isolation, abandonment felt by Yerushalayim. It focuses on the disconnect and the estrangement between Yerushalayim and her children, between Yerushalayim and her allies, between Yerushalayim and Hashem. Its tone is one of shame and despair, portraying Yerushalayim primarily as the victim. The Perek does not have a clear plot structure, rather sounds like a jumbled stream of consciousness as the victim goes through a terrible experience. The Megillah famously begins in Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. Eicha yashva badad. Ha'ir Rabati Am. How is it possible that she sits alone, this city that was once great with people, full of people? Haita ka'amana, she has become like a widow. Rabati ba'goyim, sarati ba'medinot, haita lamas. Great among the nations, a princess among the provinces, she has become a vassal. The first word in this parak, and of parak, prakim bet and dalet, chapters 2 and 4, has been adopted as the Megillah's name, Eicha, which is an elongated, mournful version of the word Eich, which means how. But this isn't a mechanical question about how something works. Rather, it's a painful question of how something could possibly have happened, reflecting the shock, the astonishment the nation experienced during the Horban. And even though Yirmiyahu and other Nevi'im of the time warned the people again and again, through generation to generation before this even, of the impending Horban, the people refused to believe it. And this refusal to believe was aided by the Nevi'i Sheker, the false prophets, who gave the people false hope that Hashem would never destroy his own dwelling place. This actually isn't the first time in Tanakh that we see the word Eicha. The first time we see the word Eicha in Tanakh is in Devarim, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Bet, chapter 1, verse 12, in Parshat Devarim, which we also actually read on Shabbat Chazon, which is the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, the day that we read Megillat Eicha. And in this pasuk, Moshe recounts his complaint to Bnei Yisrael about the burden of leading their great and unwieldy nation. And he says, "Eicha yash esa levadi tarchachem umasachem virifchem." How can I bear alone your load, your burden, your quarrels? And as Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs, Alav HaShalom, pointed out, The word Echa isn't the only similarity between these two psukim. Between Echa, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, and Devarim, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Bet, they also share the word alone. In Echa, the word Vadad, Echa Yashva Badad Ha'ir Rabati Am, how is it possible that the nation once so great with people is now alone? And here, Echa Asa Levadi, Moshe is complaining, how can I bear the burden alone? And in that way, both psukim mourn the idea of aloneness as something undesirable, even incomprehensible. Another time we see the word Echa in Tanakh is in Yeshayahu Perek Aleph Pasuk Chaf Aleph, chapter 1, verse 21, in the Haftorah of Shabbat Chazon, so named because of the first word of this Perek in Yeshayahu is Chazon Yeshayahu Ben Amotz. And this is read immediately following Parshat Devarim on the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, so also immediately preceding the reading of Megillat Echa at some point that week in Shul. And the Pasuk in Yeshayahu reads, Echa hayta lezona kirya ne'emana. How has she become a prostitute, the faithful city? Mileyati mishpat, tzedek yalinba, ve'ata miratzchim. Full of justice, righteousness resided in her, and now murderers. Here, Yeshayahu, just like Yirmiyahu, is asking, how is it possible for the once upstanding and respectable city of Yerushalayim to have stooped so low? Yeshayahu focused on the city's moral corruption and collapse, whereas Yirmiyahu focused on her intense loneliness in Echa, upon her loss of inhabitants and of her standing among the nations. But they're both mourning the loss of the high standing that Yerushalayim as the capital city of Malchut Yehuda, of the Judean kingdom, once enjoyed. There is a medrash in Bereishit Rabbah, Yotet Tet, that actually connects the word Echa to yet another time that these four letters are used in Tanakh, albeit with different nukudot. And the medrash says as follows, Ma adam harishon hichnas tiv l'toch gan eden v'tzivi tiv v'avar al tzivuyi. Just like I placed Adam, Hashem says, in gan eden and commanded him, I gave him a command, and he violated my command. V'konanti alav Echa. And I, Hashem, lamented over him, Adam, with the word Echa. Shene Amar, as it says, Vayikra Hashem Elokim el Ha'adam, Vayomer lo Ayaka. And Hashem called to Adam and said to him, Ayaka, where are you? Echa k'tiv. And it's written as Echa, because they share the same letters, Aleph Yud Chaf Hei. Af banav hichnas tim le'eretz Yisrael v'tzivitim v'avru al ha'sivoy. So too, just like Adam, when I placed him in Gan Eden, and I commanded him, and he violated my command. So too, when I placed his descendants in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, when I commanded them, and they violated my commands, v'konati alehem Echa. I also lamented over them with the words Echa. Shene Amar, as it says, Echa Perek Aleph Pasuk Aleph, chapter 1, verse 1, Echa Yashva. How is it possible that she now sits alone? Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik expounds upon this connection between Echa and Ayaka beautifully, as quoted in Misorat HaRav Kino, page 339. And I quote the words here, there. Because God asked Adam, where are you? And Adam did not confess to his sin, there will always be destruction accompanied by lamentation, Echa. The call from God, Ayaka, is not limited to the episode of Adam's sin. It comes quite frequently, through history, or through events in one's private life. But man often ignores the call. If man does not answer the Ayaka, the call, he will be destined to say Echa, to mourn. Perhaps we can also understand the connection between Echa and Ayaka in a more positive way. As Rabbi David Foreman suggests, it's almost as if we're saying Echa in mourning our loss of Hashem from our lives. Hashem, how could you do this? And while we're asking that question, Hashem is simultaneously himself saying or asking Ayaka, where are you, in mourning his loss of us from his immediate presence. It's almost as if the reciprocation of Hashem's missing us while we miss him. And I think that that can give us some measure of comfort in our mourning during our personal feeling of suffering. In the midst of the Mekonin's astonishment in Pasuk Aleph at how different Yerushalayim has become from the way that it used to be, which is actually a common feature of the Megillah, he compares the city specifically to an amana, to a widow, a woman who has been abandoned by her husband and left alone. And this is the first image to which Yerushalayim is compared. And it's an image that invokes pity and loneliness. Rashi notes that when Yerushalayim is described as an amana, the Pasuk says, Haita ki amana. Vilo amana mamash. She was like a widow, but she wasn't actually a widow. And he continues Rashi saying, Ella, ki'isha shehalach ba'ala b'medinat yam, v'da'ato lachzor etzla. Rather, she was like a woman whose husband went to a coastal country and had the intention to return to her. And in this way, the single letter chaf can provide a modicum of comfort, because even though it feels as if Hashem has abandoned Yerushalayim entirely and eternally, we know that he has really just left temporarily and will, Emir Hashem, one day return. Pasuk Bet, verse 2, continues the image of the widow with a more graphic description of her predicament. She weeps at night. Rashi explains that this might be because the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed at night. Or alternatively, maybe it's because she doesn't want anyone to see her crying, and therefore she waits until nighttime in order to let the tears fall. And the translation of the pasuk continues, "Videmata alachaya," and her tears are on her cheek, perhaps indicating that there's no one there to wipe them off her cheek. In fact, the pasuk continues, "Ein la menachem mikol ohaveha." She doesn't have a comforter from among all her loved ones. Koreeha bagduba hayu la lo ivim. All her friends betrayed her and became her enemies. The phrase "Ein la menachem," she doesn't have a comforter, is actually repeated four more times in similar variations throughout the perek, reiterating again and again that no one is willing or able to comfort Yerushalayim, neither the foreign nations in whom she had trusted, nor Hashem himself. And this idea of betrayal is actually an important theme throughout the perek, starting out in this pasuk, and Yerushalayim is being betrayed by Re'eha, her supposed friends, i.e. her allies, but also continuing on in the rest of the perek to clarify that this betrayal was a result of Yerushalayim's own betrayal of Hashem himself, an idea that we're actually first introduced to in pasuk Hey, verse 5, with the words, Ki Hashem hoga al rov pisha'eha, because Hashem has afflicted her due to her many sins. And again, we see something similar in Pasuk Chet, verse 8. Chet chat'a Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim has committed a sin. Al kein linida hayata. Therefore, she was anida, a wanderer. And according to Rashi, this language is actually related to the language used in Cain's punishment of Nava Nad Tihiya Ba'aretz, you shall be a wanderer in the land. The word Nida may also be understood as alluding to an impure woman known as Anida, which is, just to be intellectually honest, is actually spelled differently. The word Nida here is spelled Nun Yud Dalid He, whereas the word Nida referring to an impure woman in Tanakh is Nun Dalid with a Dagesh He. Which Yerushalayim is actually compared to explicitly with the correct spelling in Pasuk Yud Zayin in verse 17, which reads, Haita Yerushalayim linida b'nehem, that Yerushalayim was like an impure woman among her enemies. And this image of Yerushalayim as a nida actually relates to the first phrase in Pasuk Tet, verse 9, of Tumata b'shuleha, her impurity, in other words, her blood is on the hems of her skirts. And perhaps this is a mashal or metaphor for the spilling of blood that occurred during the Korban, or perhaps it's referencing the spilling of innocent blood in the time of Menashe, who was one of the most evil kings in Jewish history, during whose reign the Korban was actually decreed. If the word nida here in Pasuk Chet with a yud is to be understood as an impure woman, this second image of Yerushalayim is somewhat different than the image of a widow. And in fact, when she is compared to nida, in fact, in Pasuk Yud Zayin with the correct spelling. And it's different than the image of a widow in that a woman becomes a widow due to an external circumstance, whereas she becomes a nida due to an internal circumstance. Also, a widow is physically separated from her husband indefinitely, while a nida is physically separated from her husband temporarily. And so the use of the two different metaphors is likely intentional to denote these two different kinds of separation from one's support. The idea of B'nai Yishal being punished for her sins is repeated at least four more times throughout the rest of the parak, in addition to the phrase Chetz Chatzah Yerushalayim that we saw before, suggesting that their suffering is really justified. And the Mekonein seems to understand the reasoning behind Hashem's actions, horrifying though they are. The most explicit of this is actually in Pasuk Yudchet, in verse 18, in which the Mekonein explains, Tzadik hu Hashem, ki pihu mariti. Hashem is righteous, for I have rebelled against his mouth. Rabbi Chaim Angel suggests that in this way, the Mekonein seems to be expressing a calculated sense of misery in this perek, because he seems to understand why the horrific destruction has occurred. And perhaps the rational perspective of an ordered world in which everything can be well explained is reflected, says Rabbi Angel, in the intact order of the alphabet in this perek, in which each letter begins a new pasuk in the exact order that we would expect, all the way from aleph until tav, which is something that we'll see is not necessarily seen in the following perekim. Dr. Gavriel Cohn points out that the entire Perek Aleph is presented in a chiasic structure, literally in Atbash in this case, since it is an Aleph Bet acrostic, in which the first pasuk is parallel to the last pasuk. In this case, both first and last psukim of the perek use the term Rabbah. The second pasuk is parallel to the second to last pasuk. In our perek's case, they both lament Yerushalayim's lack of a menachem, of a comforter. The third pasuk is parallel to the third to last pasuk. In our case, the use of the word of the shoresh tsar, or narrow or constricted, in these psukim, and he follows it actually throughout the rest of the perek. And Dr. Yael Ziegler comments that this structure gives us a sense of cyclical pain, that there's no way out, and we therefore end in the same place that we begin, with a feeling of interminable grief. She also notes that all chiasms compel us to focus on its center. That's actually one of the goals of a chiastic structure. It starts and ends in the same way and builds both up and back to the middle, which in our case in Perek Aleph is actually Psukim Yud Aleph to Yud Bet, verses 11 and 12, when the perspective actually shifts from the Mekonin's third-person perspective to Yerushalayim's first-person perspective. And the city begs first Hashem and then the passersby to look at her pain and suffering. Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, Re'e Hashem v'habita ki hayiti zoleilash, see Hashem and look, for I have become worthless, or perhaps gluttonous, two different understandings of what the word Zulela might mean. Pasuk Yud Bet, verse 12, Lo aleichem kol ovrei derech, may you not experience this, all those who pass by. Habitu ure'u im yeshmach ov kimachovi, look and see if there's a pain like my pain. And we see here that Pasuk Aleph, Yud Aleph, verse 11, says Re'e Hashem v'habita. And Pasuk Yud Bet flips that in a very tight chiasm within the center of the larger chiasm into Habitu Uru'u, just switching the order of those two phrases. And I think that this tight chiasm between these two psukim really serves to highlight that loneliness that Yerushalayim feels and the pain that she is suffering, in that she's begging first Hashem to look at her in her pain, and then when he doesn't seem to see her, she begs the passersby to do so, and yet no one, neither God nor people, seem to care about her. We'll conclude our study of Perek Aleph with Pasuk Tet Zayin. It's not the last Pasuk, it's verse 16, but it is a famous Pasuk that I believe sums up the emotions running rampant in the Perek. Al Eila ani bochia, for these I weep. Eini, eini, yerdamayim, my eye runs down with water. Ki rachak mimeni menachem mishiv nafshi, because distant from me is a comforter who can revive my soul. Hayu banai shomemim ki gavar oyev, my children are desolate, for the enemy has prevailed. This reflects how we leave Yerushalayim at the end of Perek Aleph, chapter 1, expressing her loneliness, grief, her desperation in the wake of her destruction. Emotions that we are meant to feel upon our own reflection of her destruction as well. Thank you for studying together, Li'ilai Nishmat, Rose Foreman, Rezel Rachel Bat Aryeh Leib, and Rachel Zeitlin, Rachel Bat Shlomo.